you are Rosenbaum, not Bill Taylor. Okay.
That's right. I'm not Bill Taylor, but Bill Taylor is here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Interim Committee on the Judiciary come to order.
I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary to order. First of all, we want to apologize for those who are here waiting for us to get here to start the meeting. Unfortunately, a number of us were in the joint committee for marijuana, cannabis issues, and it just took a little bit of time of getting out of there and getting down the hall. So with that, oh my goodness, look who's here. So we also have a special guest that's going to be joining us, someone who's been no stranger to this building, someone we're very happy to see back here in the building to give us kind words and wisdom from Washington, Bill Taylor, former counsel for the Judiciary Committee for way too many years.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate it. It's nice to be back. It's you have a class act here. What can I say? And I'm serious about that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd say his words weren't always kind, but respectful.
Yeah. We'll ask Chen, if she could give us a little introduction, please.
Certainly. Chair Barker, Chair Przonski, members of the committee, I want to set the stage for you for this first presentation that we have today. It's a review of the Washington State Ignition Interlock Device Program. Now, Rep. Greenlich and Rep. Olson asked this interim if we could look at Oregon's drunk driving laws specifically as relate to the use of ignition interlock devices. Oregon has done some significant work in the last few years to bring their IID program up to speed, but we're still not seeing much in the way of compliance. Estimates are that our compliance rate is 20 to 25% for folks who are required to have ignition interlock devices. The vast majority of people do not install them. So we've been taking a look at some options, and Washington has a very successful program. The Washington model looks at both oversight of the vendors and strong accountability for offenders who should have these devices installed on their vehicles. So we've invited three folks to kind of give us a top-down overview of the Washington program and its implementation and what it looks like today, how it might affect Oregon should we choose to go that direction.
Okay, thank you. We'll call up the first panelist, Sergeant Brandon Belanti, Lieutenant Robert Sharp, and Clara Weaver, please. And before you speak, please identify yourself for the record on the your name. You don't need to have addresses and all that.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lieutenant Rob Sharp. I'm the Impaired Driving Section Commander for the Washington State Patrol.
Thank you. And good afternoon. My name is Brandon Belanti. I'm a sergeant, and I supervise the Ignition Interlock Program for Washington State.
Thank you.
My name is Carla Weaver, and I am the Law and Justice Liaison for the Department of Licensing in Washington State.
Okay, please proceed.
I think we'll start with our Department of Licensing licensing requirements.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Oh, yeah, that's fine.
All right.
Okay, thank you. I have some handouts I want to give. Okay. So this handout is basically what I did was I took our laws from 1999 to forward to what we just implemented. There you go. We just implemented in June of 2016 so that you could see what we've progressed and how we've moved forward with certain things.
Great.
So the first thing was, as in 1999, we implemented just the ignition interlock requirements, which was we had a 1 year, a 5 year, and a 10 year requirement. And it was, the courts were able to impose it if they wanted to. It says they may impose. And throughout the years, we saw that it wasn't happening. So in June of 2004, we moved forward and we moved it to where the Department of Licensing imposed it based on receiving information from the courts. So if someone is convicted of a DUI or physical control, or they're granted a deferred prosecution for DUI or physical control, we impose the sanction of 1, 5, and 10 years, depending on how many prior restrictions they have. Any questions so far? Okay. So The other thing that we also do is we impose that if they have an administrative sanction, which is based on the arrest side of our DUI law, we also allow them to get what we call an ignition interlock license, which allows them to drive during the suspension or revocation period. Some states call it a hardship license. We call it a restricted license. And we notice that that helps people out because at first, yes, it was really scary. It's like, why are we letting these people back on the road? They just got a DUI. But it works out good in Washington because we require them to get the ignition interlock. We also require them to file financial responsibility insurance. So these people are now licensed and insured and have the device in their car when they're driving. And it works out good because they're going to drive anyway. So we have seen an enormous change in the fact that our drivers are licensed and insured now.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Just one question: on our hardship license, there's restrictions such as use for only travel to school or to work, as well as for treatment. Is yours more broad and allows them to use the car as with any restrictions or not?
Okay, so we have two different type of restricted licenses in our state. We have what we call an occupational restricted license, which is for our non-alcohol or drug-related offenses, which limits them to time, days, and locations.
Okay.
And they use that for school, for work, for healthcare reasons, and to go to treatment, things like that. Our ignition interlock license has no restrictions except for the financial responsibility insurance and the ignition interlock. So they can drive 24/7 as long as they meet the requirements.
Thank you.
There's one little caveat that allows them to drive a company-owned vehicle as long as it's leased or and they're driving it for work purposes. And they can use what we call an exemption form, and they can drive that vehicle as long as they keep the exemption with them. But again, that's law enforcement's discretion if they feel they're not using that exemption in the proper way.
Thank you.
Okay. As years progress, excuse me, we changed some things. We added restrictions of 60-day requirements if there was a child in the vehicle at the time of the DUI or physical control. We added an additional 60-day requirement for the ignition interlock on top of the 1 year, 5 year, and 10 year. And then that changed, and we made it back. We made it more a longer period of time, which is basically 6 months now. And one of the other things that we did was, if they had a reckless driving or a negligent driving, reduced or amended down from a DUI or physical control, they're also required to have a 6-month IID as part of their reinstatement requirements. And then the last thing that we just did recently, I'm kind of like giving you a big picture in a small time, is we added where it's called tolling the restriction. One of the things that they could do is they could actually sit out the program, the 1, 5, 10 years. They just had to do what they call a four-month compliance-based removal, which was the last 4 months of their restriction. From the release date of the restriction 4 months prior, they had to have, be good. They couldn't have any fails to take tests. They couldn't fail to show up at their vendor. They couldn't have any, bad blows in the machine. And if they did, their restriction got extended. Okay? Well, what we did in this last legislative session was we did what they call tolling, which means they can no longer sit out the time frame, which means they have to serve every single day of the 1, 5, 10, 6 month restriction. So if they put it on for 30 days and they have a 365-day requirement, they still have to serve the 330 days. So we just keep tolling it till they meet that whole entire day-for-day restriction. Okay. Anything else, you guys?
No, but I can... we can try to work off this. So I'll present to you what the state patrol's responsibilities are in this effort, and really just to point out that it's a collaborative effort between multiple agencies, as well as the legislature, the defense attorneys. You have multiple people working on this, and a lot of this has come from legislative work groups and involvement from multiple groups across the board. So it's nothing that can be done just by one agency. But in the State Patrol, we're responsible for regulating the manufacturers, the devices, and also to do compliance and criminal investigations on those that violate laws concerning their interlock devices. But foremost, we approve manufacturers, and the importance of improving manufacturers and all the things that we do is to ensure the public's confidence in the device. Because if the public isn't confident that the device will work, they're less likely to use it. So we want them to have the confidence that this is a reliable device from a reputable company that will provide them good service. So that's where our rules are built to ensure that the public will be engaged and use these devices so they can be out there in the motoring public, and then the motoring public is protected. And so they no longer have to just try to wait out a suspension period or drive in violation of their license suspension. So to start with, we regulate the devices. We ensure the reliability of these devices that are on sound technology that's used. So we have very few manufacturers, if you look at other states in Washington as compared to some others. And that's because of our rigorous requirements. The anti-circumvention requirements that we require prevent the consumer from bypassing that device and then getting out there and looking like they're compliant when in fact they're not. So we test these devices, and we ensure that that device works properly through our testing. We test it on initial delivery when they apply to the state, and then an ongoing, there is an annual test, and then every 3 years there's an even more elaborate testing that goes on. And in fact, if a manufacturer decides to modify their device, they have to inform us, and then we decide whether or not we need to test that device further to ensure that it's still reliable. So again, there's great relationship with the manufacturers to get these things done. We want availability throughout the entire state, so we put in requirements that say the devices have to be available within 75 miles of every customer, except for our rural areas where lower economic status, they don't have businesses available in that area, so there's by statute some exempt areas. But we want all manufacturers represented throughout the entire state, so one manufacturer doesn't get a competitive edge and push out the other manufacturers. So every manufacturer is represented throughout the state, and that's ensured that reliability of those devices, as well as their company is accessible 24/7 through at least phone contact. They don't have to keep business hours of operation open 24 hours, but their company has to be accessible 24 hours a day. So it's typically by a centralized call center. It may not be in your state. It could be some others. But that's at least the customer is getting their questions answered timely. So they again, build that confidence in the device. We certify each service center annually, and that ensures that the service centers that do the installations of these devices are installing properly with calibrated devices. So we look at their calibration methods and ensure that the readings that the devices provide are accurate and don't compromise the customer and show a false positive when it shouldn't, or a false negative and not hold them accountable and protect the citizens. So that we deal with the technical aspect of the devices as well. We certify technicians. We want certain technicians installing these devices or certain standards. We don't want people that have prior, say, theft convictions or fraud convictions installing devices. So it doesn't mean you have to have a completely clean criminal history, but we want folks that are going to be good representatives of companies, and companies, frankly, want it too. But we had to build those safeguards in there, again, for that reliability and public confidence. So we regulate and certify those technicians annually to ensure that they meet our standards. One of the other things, or a couple of the other things that we do is also regulate the, or I'm sorry, conduct compliance checks and criminal investigations. While we're not mandated by statute to conduct those, in the State Patrol, since we provide that oversight, we are the agency that has the most connection to this industry. And so we know the rules and regulations, so we look for these violations. The compliance checks, though, are an educational opportunity. Compliance checks mean that we're looking for individuals that have, they're a restricted driver, they have an interlock installed, but we get reports from the companies. The companies feedback the reports from the downloads of these instruments every 60 days to us so we can review them and see if somebody has a problem trying to use their device with alcohol still in their system. Obviously, the device is protecting the public from the restricted driver from getting out behind the wheel, but the person hasn't changed the behavior. So part of the interlock is to help change that behavior of that person so they learn from it and stop trying to get behind the wheel. So when we see the positive alcohol tests, which are not a violation of law, but it's an opportunity to go meet with them. We'll go meet. We just knock on the door. It's all a consensual contact. If they don't want us there, they can tell us to leave. But I'll tell you, they want us there. We hear back a lot from these folks that the interlock was very important to them to help them change their behavior. And they're trying, but they're struggling because many of these folks are dealing with substance abuse problems. But we inform them that they're not going to ever have that interlock removed if they don't change their behavior, because they'll never get past that four-month compliance piece. So we have those heart-to-heart conversations, and many times it works, sometimes it doesn't, but at least we've tried. Those are educational opportunities. We also get feedback from the customers on how the manufacturers are doing. We'll ask them, how is the service center visit going? And we may learn that the service center needs to have a conversation as well from us because they're not providing maybe the best customer service. Or we help bridge that gap in communication between service center and customer many times. The other piece that we'll do are criminal investigations. So people that didn't get their interlock installed and they're known to be out there driving. And so our troops will go out and conduct surveillance on a house, on a business, wherever they may be parked. We'll identify what vehicles they own, which vehicles that should have an interlock, and we'll look for that restricted person to get behind the wheel of a vehicle after we've checked with the manufacturers to ensure that they haven't installed an interlock device. Because of the reporting to Department of Licensing, we should also know as well. And so then we'll conduct a criminal investigation, stop and arrest those individuals that are driving without the interlock installed. Many of these complaints come from neighbors, from family members, through legislative contacts, through constituents as well. And it's an important piece of what we do. We make traffic stops on a routine basis. We see folks without interlock devices installed. If they didn't have it installed that day and were caught, most likely they're going to do it again. So we'll follow up and do surveillance and stop those individuals because we know they don't have those devices installed. And they're suspended typically as well. Make sure, I know I've thrown a lot out here. The other aspect that we've seen is that the defense community, the defense attorneys, are now recommending that their clients actually get the devices installed immediately, which is great. Even though the courts haven't convicted yet, it shows good faith that they're trying to change behavior. And they also get credit for that time under the Department of Licensing's new rules. So it's an aggressive means in which to get that person to start changing their behavior, as well as immediate protection of the public against that behavior that they've been accused of having done. So, again, like I said, these are strong partnerships across many different groups in order to make this successful. Funding has been mentioned before that you may want to hear about how do we generate revenue to cover the costs. There are a couple of ways. We generate revenue from fees that are associated for each installation. So the manufacturers actually are the ones that are responsible to pay the fees to the State Patrol. And then I'll let you speak about Department of Licensing fees, yes. But also to the Department of Licensing. It's not the restricted person paying the State Patrol, but it's actually the manufacturer's responsibility based on the number of installations, their device certifications, their service center inspections. There's a number of activities that have fees associated. That money goes into an account that is specifically designated for impaired driving section programs of the Washington State Patrol. It's our office. So it goes right back into those activities that protect the motoring public from impaired drivers. So it's a self-funded endeavor. We also get additional money through the Governor's Highway Safety Office for these compliance checks and criminal investigations. So there's additional funds available through the federal means of your Governor's Highway Safety Office, potentially, to evaluate. I think I may have covered most key things.
Just one brief question. So in these fees, I'm hoping to hear, and I think I've heard it in the past, so you collect a little bit more off the people who can pay so that you're sure that people who can't pay are able to participate.
Yes, Chair. To answer your question, Chairman Barker, is that there is an indigency fee that all restricted drivers who have interlocks installed will pay into.
Okay, great. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that's what I was just going to say. That there is an account for indigent drivers, and it helps them with the installation, the removal, and any monthly fees that have to deal with that. So the people who are not are indigent don't pay that extra money, but the people who aren't do pay that extra money now. So it goes into a fee. When he was talking about the law enforcement part of it, anytime there's like a person is convicted or prior to conviction, I should say, they can be given a pretrial requirement. So basically before they're convicted, the judge can order them to get a pretrial device, and they note this on a document that they send into DOL, and then we note that on their record, as well as we note that 1, 5, and 10 and 6 month restriction. So law enforcement is aware when they do a check that that person has an ignition interlock restriction, or they're on the ignition interlock license because they're required to have it as well in the car for that.
I'd also like to add two more things that we've adopted here fairly recently in the last few years. Camera technology, and then most recently GPS technology. And I'd like to speak to the importance of those two pieces that we've learned over time. Camera technology is a great piece both for law enforcement and protection of the customer. And why I say that is that you can circumvent a device. We have many, before cameras, we had anecdotal evidence of a passenger blowing into the device out in front of a bar from a child, their own child, from the back seat blowing into the device. We couldn't prove it. You'd have to see it happen. Well, with camera technology, it captures each breath attempt, only the breath attempt, and we've still seen those same things. Now we can prove it. We have photographic evidence. We see children, unfortunately, blowing into these devices. We see the device going out the window to somebody else or in the passenger seat blowing into the device. So that aids law enforcement to hold that person accountable to not circumvent. But what it also does, it protects that customer from a failure that could extend their period, that four-month noncompliance period, because maybe there was a positive alcohol test, but it was their spouse who's not a restricted driver, or it was a friend who borrowed the car, they weren't present during a required random test. Well, that would be a failure. Well, it can show if they say, well, I just went into the mini mart to grab a soda and it asked for my test while I wasn't present. That would have been a violation before cameras. Now with the introduction of cameras, we can prove that the person wasn't there and they weren't able to take that test. Therefore, they wouldn't be in violation and have that time reset. So that gives them the confidence that the program's working, that it's not trying to be arbitrary and capricious to just penalize them even further when we can take steps to protect their interests as well, because they're trying many times to be compliant, and they get put in situations where the system wouldn't allow it. So cameras were very important. GPS is exceptionally important because of all those things I just mentioned that we find on camera where they're actually circumventing the devices. We couldn't prove it in court, so the person never gets held accountable. You have them showing that restricted driver handing the device to a six-year-old child to blow into the device, and you refer that to the prosecutor, and they say, I can't tell if that happened in Washington or Oregon or Idaho or Canada. I don't know if that happened in my jurisdiction, in my municipality, or my county. And what do? You can't hold that person accountable. You can't change their behavior. Now, I know there's the concern of the public being tracked, and we don't use it that way. This isn't real-time reporting in Washington. Other states do have that. Washington, we get this days, weeks, months, maybe later, depending on the case, but we're following up. So we know where people have been, but it's only for each breath attempt, but it's not an ongoing. We can't track their movements and watch where they're driving throughout the city. We just know the various breath attempts, what the GPS coordinates are, and these are folks that are going to be out in the public when they're doing this, so that anybody else could have seen them at that same spot and knew they were in the public as well. But it just helps for that accountability and protection for the citizens. But those are two key components that we just recently introduced. And they seem to be working well.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing up the camera, because I was going to ask you if you were using the camera system. So it looks like statewide now, the requirement, if someone has to have an IID, it has to be one of the camera models.
Correct. Camera and GPS are both required for all restricted drivers.
All right. And that's the other part, I guess, is from what you're saying, just to make sure we have this on the record. The system that Washington State is using requires this, and it only activates when a blow is being requested. So when you're saying the mini-mart, you would know that someone's not there because the camera is coming on saying you need to blow, and so now you got live. And then so much time will pass, and then it shuts down. And if you have someone that's there, once they take the photograph, or once they give the sample, then the GPS as well as the camera will turn off once they get the blow done, and that's captured?
Yes.
Okay, and then the other questions, in Oregon, I think we may be the only state that requires IID and diversion programs. So I believe Washington State has a similar type of program that an individual, if they've not been convicted before, not been through a DUI treatment program, they can actually qualify to have that arrest or that charge be dismissed against them if they successfully complete a diversion program. And if first of all, am I correct that Washington State does have some type of a diversion program or not?
Go ahead.
We have a deferred prosecution.
Deferred program. Same thing.
Yeah. So we do.
We also do have diversion, but the diversion is still considered a conviction in Washington State. So they would still be convicted, and at the end of their period of like sentencing, or you know, like
year,
you said,
whatever.
It could get dismissed, and then we would remove everything from the driving record. But a deferred prosecution program is another source of a diversion.
And you still have that protection of the interlock device
yes.
during that time.
Okay, and the last one is tolerance level. I'm going to say my understanding for like Oregon, I believe it's 0.02, that if you blow in and you have a alcohol on board, but it doesn't go above that number, then it doesn't count as a positive. So do you know what type of variance you have? I'm just curious if we're on the same page.
Yes, sir. It's 0.025 for
okay,
Washington
0.025.
State. If there's alcohol detected but it's below that set point, it's an alcohol warning. There's no violation. There's a notation on our record. If they do blow above a 0.025, they're given a 10-minute window to provide a subsequent test, just in case they may have used mouthwash or something along those lines. If they provide that subsequent test within 10 minutes that shows below that 0.025 or nothing, then the first test is not basically a violation.
Right.
But if they don't take the follow-up test, or they do and they're still above a 0.025, then it's considered a violation.
All right. And so just a last question, I guess, is my understanding is that you do not require in Washington State an IID in either the deferred prosecution or the diversion program?
No, we do. We require the 1, 5, or 10 years.
Okay. And that's for either – it doesn't matter if they're going through deferred prosecution or the diversion.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a question. Yesterday I was speaking to a defense attorney. He said he had a client that, and I don't know how frequently this test thing comes up, but he said every 15 minutes they'd have to blow and they're trying to drive and it was, you know, causing unsafe things. But so I said, I don't know, I would ask. I said, we're going to have a hearing today and I would ask about that.
Sure. So we have an initial test that's required prior to startup of the vehicle. The vehicle starts. Then we have a test 10 minutes later. Then we have random tests 15 to 45 minutes after that as they're driving, as the vehicle stays on. If they turn it off for greater than 2 minutes, they have to start it. You do a test again to start it up. Then we give them a 2-minute kind of a safe start window for like a stall. We call it stall protection in case they stalled on the train tracks or something like that. But beyond 2 minutes, they're required to provide another test. So it's one initially, then one after 10 minutes, then one randomly 15 to 45 minutes after that as they continue to drive.
And so is it easy to do that while you're driving, or do you need to pull over? Or?
Well, our recommendation is to pull over. Okay. That's the training we provide. Okay. But I won't pretend that people don't do that when driving.
While they're texting, too. Thank you.
Yeah, distracted driving.
It's in December, guys.
Yeah. Well, but to answer your question, it is easy to do while you're driving.
Yeah.
It's just not complicated. You're blowing into a device.
Yeah.
Some may have a circumvention where you have to hum as you blow. It all depends, or blow and suck. But it's not very complicated. You don't have to look and enter data or anything like that.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to mention was we get a lot of questions at the department that's, I don't own a car. And it doesn't matter if you don't own a car or not. You can put it in your, you know, neighbor's car, your mom and dad's car, you know, someone's car. It does not have to be one that is owned by you. It's just, it's operated. And then they say, well, I don't drive. Well, then we tell them if you don't drive, then you don't need a driver's license. So, I mean, people are going to come up with the, you know, excuses after excuses why not to get the device, but we have the answers if you need them.
Well, that's interesting, because if they say that they are not driving, then you just ship them into an ID card?
Yes, we do. Uh-huh. Because that's what they're saying, and they need it for identification.
Right.
We have an identification card.
Any further?
One more thing I wanted to say was, we have also that goes along with their program. If they find someone who's circumvented or tampered or done in, disconnected the device, we'll get notified by one of their folks, and they'll send in paperwork to DOL, and we will take action against their driving privilege for not having a functioning ignition interlock anymore. So that's one of the things. As well as if they remove it, we resuspend their privilege to drive if they've not met their requirement time frame. Then we will suspend their privilege to drive until they reinstall it.
Okay, great. Any questions from the panel? Or the committee, rather? Well, thank you very much for your testimony. It's been very helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming down. Yeah. You bet. Okay. The next item on the agenda is the overview of the sex offender registration system.
Chair Barker, Chair Przonski, members of the committee, I'm sure all of you or nearly all of you have gotten some requests in the last year for comment about Oregon's sex offender registration system. So we thought it would be a good idea to do an overview, kind of a 30,000-foot elevation overview of what's currently happening in Oregon, the changes that have happened in the last few years that you may or may not be aware of, and what we might be expecting as we implement our tiered registration system. So we've invited our folks here today to give us a broad overview of this.
Okay, so I have four people listed here, Michael Wu, Christine Herman, Malcolm McDonald, and Jeff Claybaugh. I don't know if you want to pull up the next chair, please. Go ahead, Nitty, or as you speak, please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Przonski, Chair Barker, other members of the committee, my name is Michael Wu. I'm the chair of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. The vice chair, Christine Herman, had an unexpected family issue to deal with, so she was unable to be here. excuse me. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak about this issue. We are glad for the opportunity to discuss, as committee counsel has stated, the current practice, the former practice, and the direction that the legislative changes have placed sex offender registry and classification on. We included this first slide just as sort of a general statement on criminal justice processes, just as a reminder that the sex offender registry the online registry really is just one part of an entire response to sex offenders, their placement in the community, and how to safely and how to safely manage them in that community. But also to inform that really the process comes out of some sort of adjudication, some sort of either court or some other process. That is usually the triggering event for registry on the sex offender registry itself. We have people coming out of prison with that requirement, people on probation with that requirement, people coming onto local control, post-prison supervision with that requirement. As committee counsel alluded to, we've moved to a process based on the recent legislation to classify based on risk of sexual reoffense, of sexually reoffending. And so this slide is just that 30,000-foot overview about the different agencies, the different players in that process. The two different flow charts, the one on the top is how a sex offender in Oregon would be classified and how that process would occur. The slide, the process on the bottom refers to individuals who move into Oregon from out of state. So the first process, if an individual is convicted through an Oregon court process with and that triggers a requirement to register as a sex offender, the classification process works now basically with three different groups or entities performing that classification function. If the individual is under the authority of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the Psychiatric Security Review Board undertakes that risk-based classification. If the individual was sentenced to jail and local control or probation in jail, that function of classification lies at the county level with parole and probation community correction divisions. If an individual is convicted, goes to prison, comes out on parole or post-prison supervision, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision has the responsibility for classification. Additionally, the Board of Parole also has the responsibility, there'll be a later slide on this with the specific number, but for classification for every sexual offender who had a requirement to report prior to December of 2013. After the classifications have been completed, the classifications are transmitted to the Oregon State Police, who have the duty to enter that data, to maintain the registry, and also to maintain the public website. The process is slightly different if you're moving from out of state. The Oregon State Police have the duty to determine whether or not the out-of-state conviction qualifies that individual to be placed on the sex offender, whether that requires that person to register as a sex offender. They undertake that once they've determined that that individual with that out-of-state conviction has to register in Oregon, they inform the Board of Parole. The Board of Parole then will do the classification and then transmit the classification level back to the state police. I wanted to start a little bit with the different categories, some of the different terminology that is used a lot in this area. Really the broadest category of individual with an obligation to report as a sex offender are just those individuals who are obligated to report as a sex offender and just sort of colloquially known as sex offenders. There are two subcategories of sex offenders that I did want to discuss. The first being those designated sexually violent dangerous offenders. Strangely enough, there are two types, one who are designated such through a court process. The other one, the other individuals are designated by the Board of Parole. The other distinguishing issue here is that if the difference is that if a court designates you as a sexually violent dangerous offender, what that functionally means is that you are on lifetime post-prison supervision, so you will be subject to that supervision for the remainder of your life. If you're designated as a board, a sexually violent dangerous offender, it means that when you are on parole or post-prison supervision in the community, the agency supervising you has an obligation to supervise you at the highest possible level of supervision. The gateway to being designated a sexually violent dangerous offender is what kind of crime have you committed, that's sort of the initial step. Only those who've been convicted of rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, and any attempts at these crimes are eligible for this designation. There is a second step process in terms of whether or not you exhibit the proper kinds of psychiatric and psychopathic traits that are necessary for this designation. So not everyone who's convicted of these crimes or attempts of these crimes would automatically be a sexually violent dangerous offender. There's still a second step, a second process for further evaluation. The third category, which is very important in terms of the public website, are what are known as predatory sex offenders. Again, the threshold question is whether or not you've been convicted of rape in any degree, sodomy in any degree, unlawful sexual penetration, sexual abuse, also in any degree, and attempts at these crimes, also guilty except for insanity. That is the baseline. If you have one of these convictions, you are eligible to be found to be a predatory sex offender. The second step in that process, much like the sexually violent dangerous offender process, is using a risk assessment tool to determine whether or not you exhibit characteristics that you are likely to cause harm or victimize another person. The reason why the predatory sex offender definition is very important is that, as it will become clear, it has a direct tie-in into who can be placed on the state's public website. So as I stated before, individuals with an obligation to register as a sex offender, they must register with a law enforcement agency. It doesn't have to be with the agency that investigated their crime. It just has to be a law enforcement agency or potentially also the Oregon Youth Authority. Those agencies then transmit the information to Oregon State Police as they maintain the public website and also the registry itself. Only a small number of those individuals who have a requirement to register may be posted to the public website that is maintained by the Oregon State Police. Prior to the passage of House Bill 2549 in 2013, only those registrants designated as a predatory sex offender and who met other criteria were posted to the public website. The biggest part of the other criteria was there had to be a determination that these individuals were the most likely to reoffend or to cause new harm. So it really was almost a three-step process. You had to have one of the right convictions, right criminal convictions. There had to be a determination using that instrument to determine risk. And on top of that, a further determination that you were most likely to reoffend. So it was a very narrow group of individuals who could be placed on the public website. It wasn't just those individuals who were designated predatory. It had to go through one additional step. So there are almost 29,000 total offenders right now on the state's registry. It's slightly less than 2,000 were predatory offenders. So as you can see, the effect of the law previously was it's a very narrow population of individuals with a requirement to report as a sex offender. Predatory sex offenders would even be eligible to be put on the public website. One big driver of whether or not you were going to be on the public website or not was that initial question of, well, what crime were you convicted of? The registry has been in effect since 1989. It has been growing indefinitely since 1989. As a relative newcomer to this process, it's been interesting hearing from different individuals involved with the reforms, with the legislation, that one of the things the legislature did was listen to OSP, listen to community corrections, about the fact that the registry was just growing and growing and growing, and making it more and more difficult to manage, more and more difficult to administer in a way that enhanced public safety. It's also the reason why there are so many, that number of total individuals who have an obligation to register is almost 29,000. They've been accumulating since 1989. Only those predatory sex offenders that met other criteria could be put on the public website. Currently, right now, fewer than 500 predatory sex offenders currently meet all the criteria to be placed on the public website itself. the system had some flaws, weaknesses that the legislature recognized. One of them, obviously, was that it limited the population of individuals who could initially even be considered for placement onto the public website itself. You had to be a predatory sex offender. You had to have committed one of those crimes. And while in that subset of predatories, we were using risk assessment tools to determine whether or not they had the characteristics that they might victimize other individuals, the way the law was drafted, we were only applying those risk tools to predatories to determine whether or not they should be on the public website or not. So of the 28,000 plus sex offenders with a duty to register, only the slightly less than 2,000 had these risk assessments done that would be meaningful. In other words, only out of that population of 2,000, if they were high risk, would they be put onto the public website. It prevented us from using the methodologies of risk assessment for the whole population itself to be able to look at all 28,955 to determine who was high risk and then make decisions about whether or not make decisions about placing high risk offenders onto the public website. That obviously resulted in a very limited number of sex offenders even being eligible to be on the public website. Additionally, there was a recognition that there were very limited ways for individuals who were low risk, who had been crime free for a significant period of time, to find a path to either finding some way to come off the registry as well. The new legislation was a very ambitious attempt to really apply a more calibrated approach to the registry, to who was going to be on the public website. It was going to be, everybody recognized, an incredibly large task to deal with the almost 29,000 sex offenders who were on the registry, getting them all evaluated and classified using evidence-based practices, better tools, data-driven tools. The key reform is that all registered sex offenders will be assessed to determine their risk to sexually reoffend in the community using those tools. It is a three-tiered system. Level one is low risk, level two is medium risk, and level three is high risk. All level three offenders will be listed on OSP's public website. So there isn't the continuation of the predatory or not predatory. The legislation did allow or did designate that after 2005, all court-ordered sexually violent dangerous offenders and all predatory sex offenders after 2005 would be automatically designated as level three. The Board of Parole is in charge of making that classification for them. We call them the automatic level threes, and then we still transmit that to OSP for inclusion on the public website. The board has responsibility for classifying all adult male registrants whose event triggering their obligation report occurred before January 1, 2014. We call these individuals the existing registrants. That's also in statute as well. We also have responsibility to classify all adult male registrants who've been released from the Department of Corrections since January 1, 2014, basically everybody who's come out of prison since then. And we also have responsibility for what we refer to as the other registrants. This represents the vast majority of the individuals who have a obligation to report on the sex offense registry. The existing registrants number almost 25,000. Other includes a wide group of people, all females who have triggering events, all males who were convicted as adults for crimes that were committed prior to age 18. It has to be a conviction, not an adjudication. And males convicted of certain enumerated non-contact but still registrable offenses. The PSRB, as one slide earlier stated, is responsible for classifying registrants under their own jurisdiction, and community corrections, county parole, and probation offices are responsible for registrants who were sentenced to jail and a term of probation since January 1, 2014. The risk assessment that's been adopted for the majority of these individuals, which are the adult males, that was worked out in collaboration with the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, with input from, I believe, the working group that was part of it previously. That is the static 99R. The static 99R is a 10-item actuarial assessment. It was created and normed, tested and verified for accuracy for adult male sex offenders who are at least 18 at the time of that their offense was committed. It is the most widely used sex offender risk assessment in the world. It's used in Canada, England, Australia, Europe. It's used extensively in the United States. It also has been used extensively in Oregon. The Department of Corrections and local community corrections have been using the Static 99 and the Static 99R for several years now in their own caseloads to determine risk of reoffense. It's been around since 1999 and has gone through one significant update in 2012. We had to adopt a separate risk assessment methodology for the other group, for the others group. That's because there was no, that's because the SAG 99R is not normed for those populations. It's not normed for either women or individuals committed their crime under the age of 18 or individuals who've committed non-contact but registrable sex offenses. The same work group that determined that the SAG 99R was the most appropriate risk tool, assessment tool for the adult male population, came up with a two-part way to evaluate for risk the other population. This includes the use of a level of services case management inventory. That's a criminogenic risk needs tool. It's used, I think, by every county in the state to assess criminogenic risk needs, usually for case planning for people on parole, probation, and post-prison supervision. But most importantly, these individuals would be getting an in-person sexual offense-specific evaluation to determine their level of risk. They would be meeting with a trained evaluator who would be meeting with them and conducting an in-person evaluation. The two systems have a great number of differences. Obviously, the first one is that under the previous system, your eligibility to be even considered to be put onto the public website really turned on whether or not you were designated predatory or not. There was a limited application of risk assessment methodology. It was really being applied to the predatories in terms of determining whether or not you should or shouldn't be on the public website. So, for example, if you were releasing from prison with a promoting prostitution conviction, that was not one of the convictions that you could be designated predatory on. You could have been evaluated by the Department of Corrections or Community Corrections using a static 99R. You could have been at a high risk to reoffend, scored very high, and no one would have had the ability to place you on the public website, even though you scored very, very high. The new legislation allows that risk assessment of everyone who has an obligation to report, regardless of crime of conviction. And that level of risk is now being determined using data and evidence-based practices. It made it difficult for the public who would go to the website. They would see the individuals on there, believing that they were the only individuals who were high risk. Now the public will have more accurate information about those offenders at the highest risk to reoffend in the community. Currently, fewer than 500 predatory sex offenders are on the website. We're in a transition period where we're putting level threes on, but predatories are still going to be on until December of 2018. That's only approximately 2% of the total population. We expect that with the static 99R, somewhere between 5 to 10% of the total population will come out to be a level three, meaning higher risk. Again, it was very difficult to be removed from the registry, and that would just cause it to grow indefinitely. As part of the legislation that did come in, procedures have been developed to using the classifications to figure out a path potentially to get relief from registration for those individuals who are the lowest risk. The deadline is to complete classification by December 1st, 2018. The board, since December of 2015, has had 7 full-time assessment specialists classifying adult male registrants. We are averaging about 82 classifications a month. We are working on bringing that figure up. We're conducting work studies on that. but it is a large task needing time and resources. The Oregon State Police right now have received 238 automatic level 3 classifications from the board. The board felt that it was important to have the automatic level 3s dealt with it in as timely as way as possible. One area that committee council asked us to address was what steps we've taken in terms of interagency cooperation to help enhance public safety. The board has a long history of working with the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections in terms of setting release conditions for all sex offenders releasing from the Department of Corrections. We work with them about issuing warrants and also processing sanctions for those individuals who are sex offenders who are out of compliance. With the Oregon State Police, we're working on cutting down inefficiencies. We're working on figuring out ways to transmit information more directly and more efficiently, so that the lag time between classification and if someone's going to be a level 3 and posted to the website can be cut down. And we're always working to try to harmonize our processes to ensure better communication.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Mr. Wu, just following up on one of the questions, one of the slides has pointed out that you're processing about 82 per month onto the site. We have thousands that need to be there. What's the time frame for being able to bring the site up to date?
Well, Chair Brzezinski, I think there's sort of two questions there. One is getting through all 28,000 individuals who need to be classified, and then the second question is a question about bringing the website up to date. I'll take the second part first, which is that we are able to identify certain populations which we know are going to be automatic level threes or the predatories right now, which are in transition. They're relatively easy to identify and then work on. The second question is a much more difficult question. At 82 a month, we are in a position where we are not going to get done by 2018. My understanding is that everybody who was part of this original conversation understood it was a big task to reclassify 28,000 plus. We have more releases every day, and that we are looking at ways to get better, but. There may be only so many things that we can do to improve efficiency, and we will probably need to look at possibly getting some additional resources. We were also in conversations about how to focus those resources. Are there specific populations which might be better with limited resources that we should be focusing on to enhance either community safety or to look at individuals who've been on the registry for a very long protracted period of time?
All right, if I can follow up, there's a couple of things. I guess one would be with the backlog, knowing that what the projection was supposed to be for 2018, is there a package that's going to be presented in 2017 looking for additional resources?
Yes.
Okay. And then the other part is there, I'm going to say, once someone has been identified and they should go up onto the website, are they being placed onto the site immediately, or do we have a backlog of just getting those who have already been determined to need to be on the website, actually getting them onto the website?
There are some delays in the time of classification to it being brought to OSP's attention to be put onto the website, and we're still working on cutting those down. We just actually had a conversation earlier this week about that, and are going to try to set up sort of regular feedback on that, so that if the board's figures are this month we've transmitted 20 people who we know are level 3 and should be on there, on OSP's end, did all 20 make it, or what's their status, so that we can work to make sure that lag doesn't grow too much.
Thank you.
I have a question. Maybe somebody else would answer it, or maybe I'm getting ahead of the thing here. But so I've had calls about the homeless, houseless, whatever you want to call it, somebody who doesn't have a permanent address, not registering. And the representative from Josephine County just said they just had a story in the newspaper down there about a number of people in Josephine County that aren't registered. They're supposed to be registering. And so he said the community was really upset about that down there. So I'm just wondering, I know if I'm not mistaken, that you somebody without a permanent address only has to register once a year. Is there something we can do to improve that? I took a look at requiring a much more timely registration, but the parole and probation people said that would just be a disaster because the guy says, I live under the west end of the Burnside Bridge, and the next week he's living under the east end, and so then he's going to be sanctioned for not. And they said that would just be a little bit too much. But anyway, I'm wondering about the people that are supposed to be reporting that aren't.
Well, I might defer first maybe to the Oregon State Police. They have a long history with grappling with this issue.
That'd be fine. It just so during the conversation, if somebody could clear that, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Barker and Chair Przanski, members of the committee, the Josephine County Police agencies, the Grants Pass Area Police Department, the U.S. Marshals Service, the Josephine County Sheriff's Office, and Parole and Probation recently conducted a sweep of Josephine County that lasted between September 13th through 15th, and they just recently reported to us the results of that sweep, which resulted in 279 sex offender registration compliance checks. There were 33 total arrests made as a result of those checks. 10 of those were failure to register as required. One was a sex offense arrest. 12 of those were drug offenses. There were 5 others that they didn't provide us the specific arrest category. And there were also 10 citations issued for failure to register along with release. We don't have figures yet as to how many of those were individuals that were listed with homeless residences. When a sex offender registers, they must provide a resident address. And if they are homeless, it needs to be a specific geographic location. If they change that geographic location in regards to where they are primarily staying, in other words, where they sleep at night, then they have within 10 days to re-register what the new location is. If they fail to do that, they're subject to arrest or citation. If their original conviction was a felony, then that failure to report that registration change, that residency, is a Class C felony.
If they live in their car?
If they live in their car, an example would be if a person who is transient lives in their car and they are currently parking and sleeping in the Walmart parking lot in downtown McMinnville. They would register that as their address. And then if for some reason they were needing to move to a different location, they have to re-register what the new location is where they're parking their car.
Completely crazy.
Okay,
further questions?
No.
Please proceed.
So the sex offender registration section of the Oregon State Police first came to be in 1989 when the first sex offender registration laws came to be. Approximately 7 years later in 1996, the Department of State Police created the formal sex offender registration section, which included at that time a total of 3 staff members. We now have 20. We operate with our policies and procedures guided specifically by Chapter 163 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which has to do with the sex offender reporting and classification laws in the state of Oregon. Now, what happens is registrations are received at police departments, sheriff's offices, Oregon State Police work sites or area commands, and also completed by the Oregon Youth Authority for those persons that are under their supervision. Registrations completed there are then sent to the sex offender registration section for our staff to cross-match them with the person's legal records to determine, first of all, if it's an initial registration, the very first time a person registers in the state of Oregon, to validate that that person has to register as a sex offender in the state of Oregon. Believe it or not, there are individuals each year that attempt to register that are not required to here in our state. Subsequent verifications are received which pertain to changes of address, annual registration requirements based on an offender's date of birth, If they enroll in or are employed at an institution of higher learning, or if they live out of state and are working or attending school in Oregon. Each of those registrations is also received by our staff, and it's verified for accuracy and completeness. If it is complete and accurate, it's considered a valid registration and is updated in the state database. If it is missing critical information or is inaccurate, it is deemed invalid and returned to the registering agency, and a copy also provided to the offender with the information provided that they are required to provide complete and accurate information that they need to re-report back to that agency and complete a valid sex offender registration. Now, registering agencies are able to access the sex offender registration database through what we call the web-facing portal. Some individuals refer to it as the law enforcement portal. This is a snapshot here of what it has looked like for quite a few number of years. And all law enforcement agencies, actually criminal justice agencies, are able to access the data that we maintain in the state registry. We just recently did a long-awaited update to the web-facing portal, and this is the current version that went live as of yesterday morning at 5 a.m., to be precise. And it has worked very well. What we've learned, the only problems users have experienced currently statewide is if they are using an unsupported browser or if they failed to read the instructions and make sure that they did the update necessary in Internet Explorer. After they log in, they see this, what we call our home page, and it provides them the ability to do registration forms, to conduct actual registrations, to do advanced searches on individuals that are listed in the database, to also do searches based on city locations, zip codes, counties that provide what information is available for the public. For specific sex offenders, and also to do searches based solely on what offenders are currently listed as non-compliant. We're able to identify the non-compliant offenders that have failed to report for their annual registrations, for those who have failed to register within 10 days of their release from incarceration, and also those for which OSP has been provided information are not residing at the address that they had recorded on their most recent registration. Here's an example of what one of the drop-down menus looks like, where if you were working in a sheriff's office and you were having to process a offender's registration, how you would initially access whether to determine to do an initial or what's called an update is one of the subsequent registrations. As Mr. Wu mentioned, we have the responsibility for maintaining the public predatory and the level 3 sex offender website, described under Oregon Revised Statute 163A.215, subsection 2, subsection A. This website is also utilized for continuing to post those individuals who were designated as predatory sex offenders prior to December 1st of 2018. Predatory designations were made up until January 1st of 2014, and at that time changes in state law created the tiering system where all offenders are going to be classified, as Mr. Wu mentioned, as level 1, 2, or 3 offenders. Now, if a person is not classified as a level 1, 2, or 3 offender by January 1st of 2019, current statute describes that if this is due to them failing or refusing to participate in the sex offender classification assessment, on that date they will be automatically classified as level 3 offenders. Lots of questions arise frequently in regards to what information is available to the public. The public is able to access the public website, which lists the predatory sex offenders, along with the level three sex offenders. By accessing it through the OSP Sex Offender Registration Section's website. This is what it looks like after they read the conditions of use agreement, which basically states they will not be utilizing the information they obtain to participate in any criminal activity. Any of the predatory or level three offenders are accessible through the searches that you can see there on the fillable windows. Now, continuing in regards to our primary function with the state police, the sex offender registry, and the release of information, we're asked frequently, if I can only access predatory or level three offender information, what about other registered sex offenders that I'm concerned about that live in my area or near perhaps the area my child goes to school? State statute provides that if an inquiry is made to the Oregon State Police asking about a specific sex offender, a name is provided, identifying information perhaps with a date of birth due to the vast number of offenders we have in the registry, or they can give us a specific area and provide a specific reason as to why that information is needed in the name of public safety, then we can provide registered sex offender information to that individual, either based on that specific registered sex offender, or most commonly the registered sex offenders that live within a 1 mile radius of the address which is provided. We currently receive, there's an increasing number of inquiries that are being sent into our office. It used to be that we would receive maybe one or two every 3 weeks. We're now receiving an average of 10 requests for this type of information every week by private citizens, and an increasing number from private corporations or businesses. We also, one of our primary functions is communications with both in-state and out-of-state partners. Of course, we share quite a bit through phone, email, the U.S. Postal Service, and faxing, but also utilized by 40 U.S. states is what's called the SORNA portal. SORNA stands for the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, and there is a National Sex Offender Registry. They maintain what's known as the portal, which is an information sharing web-based program, where if we receive information that one of the Oregon registered sex offenders is moving to the state of Idaho, we go to the portal and we enter that information, which is then provided to the Idaho State Police, which then takes care of notification within the state of Idaho that sex offender is supposed to be registering there within a certain amount of time. The Oregon State Police receives the same information from participating states across the country.
And I forgot to ask you, Mr. Claybaugh, you identify yourself on the record. So,
yes,
and then
I'm
also
Jeff.
We're
I'm
starting
Jeff.
To run out a little bit short of time on this presentation. So.
I'm Jeff Claybaugh. I'm the manager for the Sex Offender Registry with the State Police. Currently, we have, as Mr. Wu alluded, 28,955 records as of September 20th, 2016. And of these, we are authorized with the state police to post only 710 of those records on the public website, which represents 485 predatory sex offenders and 225 level three offenders. Three criteria that Mr. Wu alluded to that needs to be present for us to be able to post a predatory sex offender to the public website is, first of all, of course, they had to have been designated as a predatory sex offender. Secondly, while they were under supervision, notification of their status as a predator had to have been made to the public, to members of the public other than the offender's family, and they had to have been on a high level of supervision at the termination of their most recent period of supervision. OSP is authorized to post all level three offenders to the public website. In 2015, we had 28,689 registrations we received. 1,408 of those were initial first-time registrations. 27,281 were subsequents, with an average of 2,373 registrations received per month. This year, our average per month is currently at 2,383. For a national comparison in regards to where does Oregon stand to the rest of the country, we are 27th in total population. total number of people that live in the state. We are number six in the total number of registered sex offenders in our state. We follow Texas, California, Florida, Michigan, and New York. And we are number one per capita in regards to the entire country with the number of sex offenders in comparison to our total population.
Yes, please. Question.
So, do you suppose that's because we do a really good job of identifying and prosecuting and then subsequently registering sex offenders, or is there the thought that there's a disproportionate occurrence?
We're attempting right now to do some research to identify how many of the total number represent individuals that were convicted in other states and moved to Oregon, and then be able to cross-reference that with the data that we can obtain from other states to make that determination. At this time, we can't say for sure how many were required to register due to in-state convictions versus out-of-state.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Greenlick, please.
I'm not sure I have a question for the witness, but I wasn't in the Judiciary Committee when the change was made. I'm wondering what the underlying philosophy of having these particular offenders being registered in this way. I mean, it's a heinous crime if we're worried about them reoffending. That's one thing. Does registering really change the potential for their reoffending? Why these offenses? Why not a habitual physical abuse person? Why aren't we registering those? If registering does anything, is the scarlet letter model just a form of punishment? Is that, is this extra punishment beyond a prison sentence? I mean, somewhere it would be useful if we take, maybe it's just my curiosity and maybe I'm just weird. But
that's the reason we're cheering, is trying to, so we have people who are dangerous predatory sex offenders who have a high risk of reoffending, so that the agencies that deal with them can concentrate on them and not waste time watching somebody who's virtually no danger at all.
Does this change their probability of reoffending? Has there been evidence on that?
I don't know that.
Does anybody?
Time is limited at this point, but we can provide information and collect that for the committee members and the chairs to review at a later date if you would like to. Recent information we've been presented is that the U.S. Marshals Service and the National Office for the Sex Offender Registry does have data now available that shows that there is a decrease in recidivism rates for those states that have an active sex offender registration program.
That'd be great to take up during the session if we have a little more time. It'd be very useful.
That's a good idea. Thank you, Representative Greenlee.
And the other thing is, while we have in our presence Bill Taylor, you may want to just have a quick conversation with him, because he would have been the historical institutional memory as to that time frame when the policies were adopted by the legislature.
Okay. Representative Olson.
So just really quick question. Of the SOR that you have, what's the percentage of males?
I couldn't provide you that information right now, but we could certainly.
It's extremely high. Isn't it?
It's higher than for females.
It's much higher.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
That's the limit of the information I had ready to present, and we can certainly answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Claybaugh, please.
Chair Prozanski and Chair Barker and fellow committee members. My name is Malcolm McDonald. I serve as Community Corrections Manager for Clackamas County Community Corrections, Probation and Parole, and Transitional Service Programs. I'm here today on behalf of Clackamas County Community Corrections, the Oregon Association of Community Correction Structures, and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. I'm here to provide you with an overview of how community corrections plays a role in the implementation of the sex offender notification level system and the sex offender registry. Oregon community corrections agencies are responsible for the assessing and assigning levels to adults who were convicted of a sex offense after January 1st, 2014. sentenced to probation or sentenced to a prison sentence of 12 months or less in a local jail, often referred to as a local control or local supervising agency. Community Corrections is using an assessment and classification process similar to that of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to assess and assign levels to sex offenders. Community Corrections is also collaborating via the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network to ensure this process is implemented statewide in a consistent way. As you may be aware, throughout the state, there's 34 different community corrections agencies that do parole and probation work. In addition, community corrections will utilize the Oregon State Sex Offender Inquiry website as its primary source of notification. Often you may have got questions in the past, where do I find information about sex offenders? And a number of community corrections agencies had their own websites to identify high-risk sex offenders or predatory sex offenders in their community, creating confusion to the community of where to find that information. We will continue on a case-by-case basis to do media and neighborhood notifications as needed. One area the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network wants to see addressed relates to the responsibility for offenders convicted of a registrable sex offense but placed on court probation, often referred to as bench probation. As currently written in administrative rule, that responsibility falls to the local supervising authority to complete that assessment and classification. Although unintentional, we believe this does not fit within the legislative intent of House Bill 2549. Where we work to develop a more consistent and impartial method of assessing and classifying sex offenders. It is a very small population of, at this time, of about 500 offenders. Very rarely does the court place sex offenders on bench probation, but it is a population that needs to be assessed. In closing, it's important that we distinguish the difference between registered sex offenders who are under community supervision, often referred to as parole, probation, and those who are not under community supervision. Sex offenders under community supervision are subject to an extensive list of conditions either ordered by the court or by the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervisions. These conditions provide restrictions, controls, and monitoring. Parole and probation officers adjust the application of these conditions based on the results of risk assessments, polygraphs, and input from treatment providers. In addition, responsivity factors such as mental illness, developmental disabilities, and various medical constraints also affect the application of those conditions. In contrast, registered sex offenders who are not under community supervision are only obligated to comply with registration laws. The exception to that are level 3 sex offenders, where 2 specific laws apply to that population to offer an additional protection and constraints or restrictions. ORS 163489, in summary, level 3 sex offenders may not knowingly communicate in any manner with a person under 18 years of age with the intent to commit a crime or for the purpose of arousing or satisfying the sexual desire of this individual or another person. Secondly, ORS 163.476, in summary, level 3 sex offenders may not knowingly enter or remain in or upon the premises where persons under 18 years of age regularly congregate, schools, child care centers, playgrounds, and other places intended for the use primarily by the persons under 18 years of age, and for persons under 18 years of age gather for regularly scheduled educational or recreational programs. The sex offender notification level system, by way of the OSP's website, provides a centralized location that our citizens and our community members can find out information about high-risk sex offenders in their community. It's one piece of, or one tool that we rely on to help keep the community safe, but it alone, on its own, cannot do that. And I when I talk about sex offenders in the community, I talk about education and prevention as an important role in us protecting our children and our community. And one of the amazing stats that I will refer to, which I get from an organization called Darkness to Light, is that 90% of our children that are victimized by someone they know and trust. And in the field that I work in, we see that over and over. So that's the point I like to make. And I'm available for questions, and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much, panel, for your information. It's very useful. I look forward to getting the additional information. The next item on today's agenda is representation in the Juvenile Dependency Proceedings Task Force Report and Recommendations. I call the Honorable David Brewer and Nancy Cosine, please.
Oh, Eddie will come up, too.
Okay. And Eddie will come up, too.
All right.
We'll call her later.
Ms. Chair?
Yes.
If I could, before they start, first I do want to thank the governor for her dedication to this issue over the years. And, you know, a lot of the things we do in the legislature can be very frustrating, but this is an example of the way government is supposed to work. And this task force, the product we have come up with, is, I think, extraordinarily good. We had, obviously, the good fortune of having Justice Brewer as the chair of the task force, and anytime you have him involved, the product's going to be good just because he's that good. I am a little upset with the governor at this point because she did bring Addie in to do the real heavy work on this thing, and she is an absolute jewel, but now she's leaving us, and she's not leaving the state, but she's leaving the governor's office, and I wish there had been some way we could have found to keep her, because she is an incredible young woman. So I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you.
Chair's
Want to make her cry? Is that the deal?
How do I follow that? Members of the Joint Judiciary Committee and the Human Services Committees of both the Senate and the House. I'm Dave Brewer. I'm a judge on the Oregon Supreme Court and the chair of the Task Force on Legal Representation in Childhood Dependency Proceedings. And I really want to thank you for setting aside time for us today to present the findings and recommendations of the task force. And it's my privilege to provide a brief overview of our work, which will be followed by some brief comments from other members who will provide you with more specific information on several key issues. We really appreciate your provision of space in this building. And as my colleague Senator Cruz just pointed out, a remarkably talented staff in Addie Smith from the governor's office, who's here with me today, and Shannon Newell, your counsel, to facilitate our work. And we also appreciate the opportunity through SB 222 to engage in a deep assessment of Oregon's current dependency representation practices and to recommend some comprehensive solutions that we believe and hope will advance the interests of our most vulnerable children and families. It's been an honor to chair the task force, to work with the governor, members of the Legislative Assembly, and so many committed professionals across the state who've given a lot of their valuable time to this process, and a special thanks to Senators Cruz and Przanski, Representatives Taylor and Stark, for their dedication as members of the task force to this issue and their work with us over the past year. As you all know, the juvenile court dependency system supports and oversees the larger child welfare system in Oregon, and it's the system that protects the legal rights of parents, promotes sound decisions, and good outcomes for children in dependency cases, and ensures that the Child Welfare Agency, the Department of Human Services, is accountable to the laws and policies that govern its work. A strong dependency system is key to a well-functioning child welfare system, and that's why the work of this task force couldn't have been more timely in our view, and why our findings are far from surprising also, I think. Over the course of the last year, the task force, which is comprised of 18 members from all three branches of government, all stakeholders in the dependency process, and local and national experts, gathered information on our child welfare system, including our current models of dependency representation, promising local practices, and nationally recognized best practices. The task force held 10 full meetings with various opportunities for court observation and meetings with practitioners. We supported 5 subcommittee processes and engaged in many informal stakeholder outreach meetings. The task force held meetings, full task force meetings, in Multnomah, Lynn, Jackson, and Marion counties, and offered opportunities for public comment at each meeting. As a group, we did our utmost to ensure that a robust and fair process governed everything we did. We welcomed and personally sought input from a wide range of stakeholders. We encouraged everyone on the task force to ask tough questions about the system and everybody's role in it. And so I think a spirit of respectful objectivity was what spurred us to take a fresh, hard look at the efficacy of our current representation models and to think beyond the status quo with the paramount goal of putting the needs of children and families first. So with that preface, our extensive review resulted in a number of key findings, the most critical of which I'd like to highlight for you now. First, Oregon's current system for government representation in dependency cases is a national outlier, because it does not provide comprehensive representation, either in court or between hearings. It leaves the Department of Human Services open to potential liability and its caseworkers to ongoing risk of unlawful practice of law. In addition, it is inefficient, costly, and provides inconsistent practice across the state. And significantly, although attorneys for parents and children are subject to performance standards adopted in collaboration with the Oregon State Bar, government attorneys in Oregon do not currently have corresponding statewide performance standards to guide their practice. Second, Oregon's current system for parent and child representation in dependency cases does not meet the needs of children and families. With the exception of 3 counties, an antiquated payment system and a history of underfunding have forced attorneys for parents and children to take on excessive caseloads, where they constantly triage court appearances and emergency calls that often prevent them from working effectively on their cases to provide sound preparation and advice to their clients. In 3 counties, however, that's not the case, where the Parent and Child Representation Program, a national best practice program, has been introduced. Attorneys in those 3 counties, Lynn, Yamhill, and Columbia, are paid based on a workload model that includes caseload caps, limiting their work. In these counties, attorneys for parents and children are able to spend the time necessary to prepare for court, work with clients to support better outcomes, and avoid unnecessary case emergencies. Third, CASA, which is the court-appointed special advocate program in Oregon, does not have the resources it needs to support its volunteers when legal advice and guidance are necessary to move a case forward. The work of these dedicated citizen volunteers is integral to a child welfare system that depends on public trust and confidence, and they need additional legal support that can be provided at a modest cost. Finally, Oregon lacks coordinated quality assurance processes to track dependency data and issues, and does not provide a feedback loop to practitioners who can implement solutions to the problems they face. That situation, we believe, should be remedied to foster a model of constant system improvement based on emerging best practices. In light of these findings, and after assessing many alternative models of representation around the country, the task force makes some recommendations that, if implemented, will produce, we believe, comprehensive changes that are necessary to better protect the rights and interests of children and families in this system. First, we strongly recommend that the Department of Human Resources or Human Services have full representation from the filing of an original dependency petition to the completion of child welfare court cases. In the current system, DHS is the only party to a juvenile case that is not consistently represented by counsel throughout the course of the case. This is the agency charged with making serious safety and permanency decisions that affect the lives of children and families, sometimes forever. And it should have consistent advice and legal counsel at every hearing, like all other parties to these cases. Representation should include both attorney presence in the courtroom and regular access to and oversight from attorneys throughout the life of a case. This will help prevent the unlawful practice of law in court hearings by DHS employees. It'll promote case practice that is consistent with the laws and policies in this state. And it will support caseworkers who are currently overburdened. We heard that concern expressed in all of our visits around the state and from many witnesses who testified. And in some cases, these folks are burning out because of the extra volume of legal type work that they currently have no choice but to perform. Second in our recommendations is to ensure full representation. The Department of Justice, which by statute is the entity in Oregon that represents DHS, we believe should adopt a flat fee billing model and staff cases according to a workload model that also includes a case cap. Dependency cases are like no other cases handled by the Department of Justice. They bring lawyers into court on a daily basis. They require regular and consistent contact and oversight of the agency client, and that client actually includes hundreds of different employees who need direct access to legal advice on a regular basis. Because of the unique and intense nature of the work, an appropriate billing model is required that's tailored to the work. In addition, we believe that DOJ should work with the Oregon State Bar to adopt and put in place performance standards that guide consistent high-quality practice statewide. Our third recommendation involves district attorneys. In Oregon, they represent an entity that is distinct from the agency by statute, the state of the people. This is unique in dependency practice. Nothing in our report or recommendations is meant to prevent district attorneys from continuing to perform this role. That being said, the task force, cognizant of state budget constraints, recommends that funding that's allocated to the Department of Human Services be used to ensure full representation of DHS so that it can replace the current inadequate and fragmented system with a more functional representation system that the importance of the agency's work demands. Fourth, the task force recommends that funding be provided to roll out the Parent and Child Representation Program, which is the workload contracting model that includes those case caps I talked about, to all counties across the state, not just the three pilot counties. This program, which is a nationally recognized best practice adapted from a successful model in our sister state, Washington, provides attorneys with the time they need to better engage clients and proactively manage their cases. In our three pilot counties, it has already begun to improve outcomes for parents and children. Finally, among a series of other recommendations for system improvement, I want to highlight three very briefly. First, we recommend that resources be provided to CASA so that its volunteers have access to adequate support when they need it from lawyers. Mm-hmm. It's imperative that as parties to dependency proceedings in those circumstances where they need counsel, that they receive it. Second, we believe that a continuous quality improvement team should be formed to monitor the efficiency of the dependency system and to provide that feedback loop I described to promote constant system improvement. And third, the task force has asked that a voluntary group of individuals continue to meet to promote the implementation of our recommendations as well as constant system improvement. A group is already meeting of volunteers to look at recommendations that don't require legislative action, and it is discussing additional recommendations that it may bring before you as things progress. To close, this isn't the first time that Oregon has examined its dependency representation system. It is, however, the first time that solutions proposing cost-effective, adequate representation for all statutory parties have been recommended. Driven by a three-branch process, principles of due process, and a search for better outcomes, this task force was committed to look beyond what we have now and truly promote positive change, along with the inevitable compromise that outcome-driven progress requires. So we hope that our findings, our recommendations, will serve as a statewide call to action for legislators, judicial officers, department directors, and legal leaders to implement and continue this important work. And with that, I thank you, chairs, and we'll yield to our next presenter, Nancy Cosine, who is Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services, and she will describe in more detail the recommendations to improve representation for our children and parents.
Nancy. Thank you. Thank you, Justice Brewer. Chair Barker, Chair Przonski, I'm sure we'll be back, members of both committees, and Council Newell, thank you for having us here today. I am the Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services, a lawyer by training, and we're taught that when someone else states what you're going to state, but more eloquently, you should just not speak. And Justice Brewer has done an amazing job. So at the risk of ruining what he has already created, I'm going to give you a little bit more background on the analysis that was undertaken with regard to the representation of parents and children. The Alternative Models Subcommittee was tasked with identifying different models used around the country and assessing whether or not they provided the kind of representation that we'd like to see here in Oregon. Those models were a state public defender model, where every employee was a state, or where every attorney is a state employee, an hourly payment system, a per-case payment model, a parent representation program model that we currently use in three counties, as described. Also, we looked at the current system, which involves a payment per hearing or per event. And then we looked at a hybrid model, which was something that involved both a state public defender office, regional hubs, and then the PCRP program. When the subcommittee evaluated these different models, it looked at several attributes of a quality legal representation system: consistency, continuity, availability of counsel, local community connection, manageable caseloads, outcome-oriented practice, how cost-effective the system was, whether or not it involved multidisciplinary representation, and whether or not it had an extended scope and duration of representation. The committee was looking at systems that would provide data-driven, positive outcomes in a cost-effective manner. Oregon's current model that is used in the majority of our counties, sadly, did not rank well. It was not a surprise. As already described to you, there are some challenges in that system, including excessive caseloads, lack of time with clients, and inability of lawyers to do important functions outside of court, like visiting with children, meeting with adult clients when necessary, meeting with service providers, attending family decision meetings, team decision meetings, and other critical out-of-court functions with their clients. The parent and child representation program ranked very highly. The only other programs that ranked similarly were the public defender model and the hybrid model, but those came at a much higher price. The features of the parent-child representation program that created the high ranking were that it offers a client-centered, sustainable legal representation model. It offers case managers who can help lawyers navigate difficult issues, and it provides quality assurance from our office. So lawyers get enough funding in that program to ensure that they can have an office location, an adequate staff, as well as the ability to participate in all case events. They have caseload limitations, as mentioned, case managers, and they have additional training and support. When we look nationally at other states that have used this model, we see that there are cost savings. In Washington, the savings was estimated to be at about $7.5 million per year. In New York, they estimated that they were saving around $9 million per year by improving their representation model. And you will see that I submitted written testimony that has more expanded information on these topics. But given the time, I'm trying to give you the highlights. So I invite you to look at the written testimony. What I can tell you is that in Oregon now, we have very difficult cases, things that involved unexplained injuries, drug and alcohol use, chronic housing insecurity, domestic violence, really, really difficult family situations, and we're having positive outcomes where attorneys and case managers are working together and with the agency to ensure that families, where appropriate, have safety plans in order to stay together and also utilize other family resources to keep family placements whenever possible. Our external stakeholders have been giving us very positive feedback on the program, which is exciting. And additionally, the PCRP has shown the counties that have the PCRP have had some really notable trends. We've seen reduced use of foster care beds of about 13% in our PCRP counties when the statewide average is up by 0.5%. We have seen that in our PCRP counties, the reunification rate increased by about 6.5%. The statewide average was 1.7. And in our PCRP counties, the use of guardianship actually increased by 111%. The statewide rate was 12.5. So while we can't say that we have a scientific study that demonstrates that these were all caused by our program, what we can say is that we're looking at the data in these counties and we're seeing some really positive trends. We don't have legislation yet, but it's being drafted. And so at a very near juncture, we will be asking you to support legislation that will help enact the recommendations of the task force. I want to reiterate Senator Cruz's gratitude to the governor and to the legislators and legislative staff and everyone else who dedicated many hours to this very thorough examination. And I also want to thank Amy Miller in my office, who also contributed a lot of work to this task force. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Thank you, Nancy. Thank you. Appreciate it. Our next speaker, chairs, is Clyde Saiki, the director of the Department of Human Services. He will describe the needs of DHS in Oregon families and how improved systems of representation can support DHS's current reform efforts. Clyde.
Thank you, Justice Brewer. Chair Barker and Przanski, Vice Chairs Cruz, Olson, and Leininger. For the record, Clyde Saiki from the Department of Human Services, and thanks for the opportunity to testify before the committee. This is a very important and critical issue for our caseworkers. I was in a meeting the other day with Representative Krieger, Senator Cruz, and Senator Roblin, and Representative Krieger reminded me that this is really an issue we've been working on for almost 12 years now without any resolution. And during that time, our caseworkers have continued to participate in court proceedings without representation. And I will tell you that in talking to caseworkers, supervisors, program managers, this is always one of the top issues on their list. And in fact, feedback from our staff is that the lack of representation and asking our caseworkers to go to court by themselves is actually one of the factors that is leading to the high turnover rate we have among our caseworkers. So Justice Brewer did a great job in his presentation about touching on some of the reasons this is so important to us, and I just want to very quickly reiterate some of those issues. He talked about the support, consistent support through the life of a case from petition to permanency, and that's one of the biggest issues that is brought up by our caseworkers. It's very difficult. In some cases, we have different entities representing us during the life of the case, and it's very difficult to achieve any kind of consistency on how we're dealing with the issues. Training and consultation is a huge issue. We really are entering court at times not as prepared as we could be because we're asking caseworkers to write their own court reports, and we don't have access between hearings to really talk about the case and talk about strategy and talk about the important things that we should be looking at. My staff have told me that even when we have representation in court at times, Our caseworkers don't feel like the people who are representing us are truly representing the agency. They're representing the state of Oregon. And that may sound like kind of a semantics or not much of a difference, but actually it's a big difference. And we really feel that the representation should be not just for the state of Oregon, but for the agency as well, and the things that the agency is trying to accomplish. And lastly, the issue of consistency of representation that Justice Brewer mentioned. I feel very strongly that the representation we have in court and the result of the court proceedings should be consistent across the state to the greatest extent possible. People should not be advantaged or disadvantaged because of where they reside in the state of Oregon. So I really want to end by thanking Justice Brewer and Addie Smith and the governor and the rest of the members of the task force. So I've been in state government for 30 years, been asked to serve on a lot of committees and task forces, and will readily say that this is one of the best experiences I've ever had. The organization and the way Justice Brewer and Addie ran the committee, the full engagement and participation by the members of the committee made me very proud to have my name associated with the final report. And what I would ask is that after 12 years, I would really ask for your support in accepting and implementing the recommendations in the final report. And by doing so, I think it will lead to better outcomes for children and families in the state of Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do want to say, about 12 years ago, I served on a human services subcommittee on the oversight of the Child Protective Services, Child Welfare Services. And it struck me, from a lay perspective, that the caseworkers were being forced to practice law in a way that seemed completely inappropriate to me. Now I've heard Justice Brewer refer to it as illegal. It seems to me, whatever else goes on with this task force report, we need to stop that as soon as possible. They were stressed by it, embarrassed by it at the time. But if it's illegal, we shouldn't be fostering it. And, whatever else goes on with this report, we ought to be doing something about that. And Clyde, you ought to be doing something about that immediately.
Yeah.
Does that seem strange?
So, Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, and Representative Greenlick, I agree with you 100%, and that cheer you hear in the background is every child welfare worker in the case of Oregon applauding your comments. And I'm, again, hopeful that we've finally gotten to a point that with the task force report and the recommendations, we'll be able to stop that.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I could, just to follow up on what Clyde said, in my view of the world, a lawyer representing the state is representing the agency, because the agency is the state. And part of the problem we have now with this disjointed system is the inability of a caseworker and a lawyer to meet before they go to court to make sure that everybody's on the same page. This will allow that to happen.
Even meeting with a lawyer.
Huh?
Even meeting with a lawyer. And they went in bare. They go in bare now frequently. It's crazy.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Clyde, so much. And our next speaker, with your indulgence, is Deputy Attorney General Fred Boss. Fred, if you'd come on up. He will describe the current agency representation system, the need for change, and how the government representation recommendations of the task force report address those needs. Fred?
Thank you, Justice Brewer. Thank you, excuse me, Chairs Przanski and Barker, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am the Deputy Attorney General. Because of the importance of dependency representation to the Attorney General and our client, DHS, I personally sat on and participated in this task force. I, too, want to thank the legislature for putting into motion this thoughtful and deliberative process, and in particular, Senators Cruz and Przanski, as well as Representatives Taylor and Stark. I would like to also thank Justice Brewer and, of course, Addie for their strong leadership in this critical issue. It has become evident over the past few years that our billable hour model may not fit the work of our child advocacy section, the section that that represents DHS's child welfare division, in a proper manner. This section's work is unique in DOJ. Our attorneys in the courtroom, we have attorneys in the courtroom every day, and they prepare for and litigate hundreds of hearings per month. The work of DHS Child Welfare also requires regular and consistent client contact on critically important decisions related to child safety and families. It has also become clear to us that DHS caseworkers need regular consultation and representation from DOJ attorneys throughout the life of a case. DOJ caseworkers need their own lawyer representing them in the courtroom on all hearings so that judges can make decisions based on all relevant facts and applicable laws. Recognizing that the current model of government representation, including our billable hour model, was not optimal, the Task Force Subcommittee on Alternate Models crafted models of representation based on best practices from other states and best practices here in Oregon. After ranking each model, a DOJ caseload model with a flat fee funding structure rose to the top. It is this model that was ultimately voted by the task force and ratified in the final report. The Department of Justice agrees with the decision of the task force. Negotiating a flat fee assessment model with DHS based on a caseload model will allow us to work proactively with DHS on cases from start to finish. We also agree that having performance standards in place for our attorneys is important, and we have already held our first meeting earlier this month at the Oregon State Bar, where we begin to craft those standards.
This is groundbreaking.
Although the change to the model of DOJ representation of DHS is just one of many recommendations in this report, the Department of Justice voted in favor not just of this recommendation, but of the entire report. Thank you for the opportunity to be part of this task force and for all of your hard work on this issue. And are you willing to take any questions that you have?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I could. First off, Fred, thank you for your dedication to the work of this task force, but I want you also to share with your boss, the Attorney General, that your willingness to step outside the box was absolutely critical for this product. This is groundbreaking what we're doing, and I want to thank you for your willingness to do what's right, and this is a great product.
Chairs, members of the committee, Senator Cruz, thank you. And I'll pass that on to my boss.
Well, Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I think we have a larger issue. I think the whole way that DOJ charges our agencies for representation services gets in the way of the best practices on how our agencies receive legal help. I don't know whether it's our committee that has to do with this or whether it's the administration committee or somewhere, but I think we ought to look at this whole question because I think our agencies get sometimes weird help in weird ways, partly because of do we spend the money with this hand or do we spend the money with this hand, but it's the same money. And somebody ought to be looking at that.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, if I may address that. This is an excellent experiment for us.
Yes.
And so we enthusiastically embrace this, primarily because of our current concerns to what you just brought up. And so for us, this is a large enough group of attorneys and support staff, and the funding involved is significant enough in our budget that it is a meaningful experiment. We have run this experiment before, and therefore we have confidence that it will work. But this is really the test drive for us to see whether or not this type of model can be used on a well, a complete agency for us basis, so that we can better deliver legal services to our client agencies. So this, I'm glad you recognize that. I'm glad you brought that up, Representative Greenlich. And I just want to state here that this is something we're really enthusiastically test driving.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Brad, very much. And chairs and members of the committee, our next speaker is Matt Shurtcliffe. Matt is a member of the task force. He's the Baker County District Attorney, and he's come here from Baker State today. And he will describe the role of district attorneys in dependency cases and the Oregon District Attorney Association's concerns. Matt?
Chairs Przanski and Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matt Shurtcliffe, as Justice Brewer said, and I am the Baker County District Attorney, and by the way, that's 300 miles away on the other side of the state. I was also one of the two representatives of the ODAA, from ODAA on the task force, and Rod Underhill was the other member. He couldn't be here today because he's out of state. I do want to thank Justice Brewer and Addie as well. Senator Cruz, you're right. Addie might be the most organized person I've ever met, and Justice Brewer did a great job of leading us, and they both provided me lots of coffee when I drove all the distance across the state. Everyone on the task force worked really hard. I was impressed. Lots of good work and examination of the system was done by the task force, and we as ODAA members agreed with almost all the findings. A lot of good work was done, especially in terms of representation. DHS caseworkers shouldn't be in the courtroom by themselves, those kind of things. But one area we do disagree is the best model for government representation in the state of Oregon. Before I talk about that, I want to go back a little bit and look at the work that you've done as legislators over the years, especially as it relates to public safety and children, because we get into a focused picture, and sometimes I think it's important to step back and look. Many years ago, the legislature, you provided for multidisciplinary teams in our counties, and you decided that the 36 elected DAs should lead those teams. And then that process evolved over time, adding Carley's Law Review, drug endangered children protocols, and many different protocols that continue to evolve in a good way. Making decisions at the local level on a weekly basis is what I do and what senior deputy DAs do, using the protocols that you put into effect. Dependency cases are intertwined in that process, and it's impossible to separate them. And I can't underemphasize that enough. There's an interplay between decisions I make each week, leading my MDT in terms of charging, and dependency decisions that are intertwined with that MDT process and all those protocols that you've put into place over the years. You recognize that created accountability to our constituents based on our knowledge of our communities, and we believe the model being proposed, the block grant model, would take away that local accountability and would undermine the progress we've made in that MDT process. Another example of when the legislature, when you recognized local communities are best positioned to address public safety, is with adult corrections. Several years ago, you passed Senate Bill 1145, transferring state supervision of adult offenders to counties, provided funding. You did it again recently with House Bill 3194, which is working, providing grant funding to improve community-based programs for corrections. This was a recognition by you that local communities are best situated to deal with these issues, and we believe the same thing is true for dependency, especially with the MDT structure and evolution to the MDT process that's in place at the local level. So getting into more specific aspects of dependency work, 33 of Oregon's 36 district attorneys participate in the process through jurisdictional hearing. 19 counties share approximately $2 million in state and general fund money, which comes through individual agreements with DHS. For most counties, though, this barely covers half the costs. The rest is covered through county funds. 14 counties do the work despite not receiving any state or federal dollars, and they do it out of concern for their children and families in their community. Another important aspect I think is important to not overlook is that all 36 DA's offices are active in delinquency cases, criminal cases involving juveniles. In several counties, there are crossover youth models. One of the recommendations of the task force, which we totally agree with, is that delinquent and dependent youth should be coordinated. So DA involvement in dependency cases is essential for those crossover models to continue to happen. In terms of the representation issue, we work with DHS caseworkers and we present the case in court. We're usually in agreement with DHS, and I think that's gotten overlooked a lot in the process. There's a ton of agreement with DHS in moving forward on cases. we try to get the best outcome. And this occurs despite not technically being DHS's attorney. And this, in our opinion, is healthy. Attorneys assigned to specifically represent DHS are ethically bound to follow their client's directives. So although we are often in agreement with DHS, there's a significant value, we believe, in having independent, community-accountable voices in our courtrooms. The task force recommended the DOJ block grant model, and we disagree respectfully about that. And I'm not here to say that DHS shouldn't have attorneys. What I'm here to say is that use of that money needs to be looked at carefully, and it needs to be done efficiently. We can spend too much money on attorneys and overlook foster care and training. Training is the key issue for caseworkers feeling comfortable in the courtroom. Deputy DAs working with caseworkers, learning how to best present their case. Too much money can be spent on attorneys. Police officers don't have attorneys in the courtroom. Parole officers don't have attorneys in the courtroom. DHS caseworkers need representation. They need quality representation, but they need it because with deputy DAs who are well-trained and them being well-trained. And we don't want to cut funding that limits the independent voice in our courtrooms. We got to be careful not to create a one-size-fits-all model that might better be localized. We continued to hear throughout the task force that district attorney's offices, some of them weren't sufficiently engaged. Unfortunately, none of the names of those counties were ever revealed. But the District Attorneys Association is committed to do whatever it takes to help those counties with additional training and expertise. There may be counties out there that need to continue to improve, but I know there are a majority of the counties and many counties that are doing this work well. Over 20 years I've been out in Baker County, for 15 as a district attorney, chairing my MDT each week. It's a big part of what I do. It's a big part of what I do to prevent child abuse, and dependency is a big part of that. Taking a step backward in that process will hurt what I can do for my community in terms of protecting children. Washington County, Clackamas County, Multnomah County, Marion County, all have these populated counties here have dedicated deputy district attorneys full-time working these cases, have good relationships with DHS, and do a good job and have full-time staff working on it. And I don't want that to get overlooked. They do a great job, and I think overall in the state, the DAs are doing a good job. This new model will likely result in steps backwards in those counties who have been doing this work and who are committed to doing the work in the future. In conclusion, I would ask that you take a look at your county and what's happening in dependency. Go back and do what we couldn't do completely in the task force, although we did a lot, and we went to other counties. Assess its strengths and weaknesses, and decide what you think about where the resources should be used. Take a look at the task force materials, though, because district attorneys did not just submit the status quo. And I believe you have those. I think we provided them to administrative. Okay. I would ask you to really look at that, because our proposals do have benchmarks for our work, competitive grant models that we can get involved in and DAs can be committed to, like four-year contracts, measuring our work, models for training, and if I could emphasize one thing today, it's the lack of training that's really happening around the state, not necessarily attorneys. We also recognize in that fifth model that DHS does need, in respect to Clyde, they do need certain representation, specialized representation at certain times. And we created a proposed DA assist model with DOJ attorneys that could help work on that and provide that. So take a look at our option five, because I think it maintains that independent accountability but provides for training, and I think really does a good job of fixing what we're dealing with. In the end, we will work with DHS and DOJ to improve in jurisdictions where that needs to occur without sacrificing the gains made in high-performing counties, and we have a lot of high-performing counties. We're committed to do this work and do it well. I believe that it's vital for local accountability that we as district attorneys with that independent voice in the courtroom that's accountable to local constituents do this work. And in the end, we believe it's in the best interest of children and families in our communities that we do this work. Thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions.
Any questions?
One. Go ahead. I guess just one comment. Matt, and that's your analysis or comparison, I guess, of police officers being in the courtroom on their own. I mean, those are violation charges that they're representing the state or their cities, as compared to DH workers being involved in child dependency. It seems to me the balance of what's in the offering is significantly different.
Senator Prusansky, Chair, yeah, it is different. But there are, I guess my point is, there are a lot of entities out there that don't have representation. And my point is, and you're right, it's different. And the child welfare work can be a little more in depth. But if a deputy DA is doing their job right, or a DOJ attorney is doing their job right, they're defending that person in the courtroom. They're meeting with them. Objecting when they need to be, meeting with them afterwards, working on getting better. My experience isn't that the caseworker needs their own personal attorney. They need just a strong advocate. Just like a police officer would have a strong advocate in a trial. Their own personal attorney for DHS issues, that really comes down to things like immigration or smaller, more civil type issues, in my opinion. They are represented if everybody's doing their job right. If there's a difference of opinion between the DA's office and DHS, DOJ, under our model, would come in and be able to assist them. So they will always have an attorney in the courtroom. They'll always have an advocate. But my point is that police officer or that probation officer isn't my client in any other case. No more than the need that DHS needs a personal attorney. They just need a strong advocate. So I hope I answered it. I agree it is a little different, but I think that we've gotten lost in the need for multiple attorneys. We just need a strong advocate in the courtroom for caseworkers. How we label it isn't the important thing. It's the training and the work that they get done. And the training's not there. Caseworkers all over the state are under-trained, and we need multidisciplinary training with prosecutors going to training with caseworkers, just like we do for DUIIs, learning how to do cases better. I think that would answer it and then help solve the problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All
right. Thanks, Matt, very much.
Thank you.
And with the indulgence of the chairs, we're just about finished. And I've asked Addie Smith, whose last day working with the governor's office is today, lamentably, to close out for us. Please, Addie.
Thank you, Justice Brewer. Yeah. Chair Prusansky and Chair Barker, members of the Joint Judiciary Committee and members of the Senate and House Human Services Committee. I'm Adrienne Smith, or Addie, as has been mentioned today. And I was the task force administrator for the Task Force on Legal Representation in Childhood Dependency Proceedings. You should see my card. It was very long. I want to personally thank task force members Senator Cruz and Prusansky and Representatives Taylor and Stark for their dedication, guidance, and time over the past year. This was a time-intensive process. On behalf of Governor Brown, I want to thank this incredible panel of experts, the 18 members of the task force, and the countless stakeholders and very passionate advocates from across the state who helped to guide the work of the task force over this past year. This is an issue of particular importance to the governor, who has not only fought for better representation in the legislature, but also in the courtroom. The issue of representation in dependency proceedings is not a new one to the state, as we've heard a few times. Over a decade, various work groups, task forces, and advisory committees have sought solutions to this challenge, but none took the comprehensive, holistic, and outcome-oriented approach that was taken by this task force. This report and the corresponding legislative concept that's proposed, so there's a LEDGE concept that's up on OLIS, they propose major reforms for all of the systems that provide parties with representation in Oregon's dependency proceedings: the agency, children, parents, and CASA. In addition, this report and the corresponding legislative concept proposed to put in place a quality assurance process to ensure that these changes and the legislature's investment improve outcomes for Oregon children and families. And if they don't, to provide a direct feedback loop, both to providers and to you all, the legislature, for ongoing system improvement. The governor appreciates the hard work and compromise that was required of all participants to come to these solutions, stands behind the recommendations of the task force, and looks forward to working with you on their implementation. After more than 10 years, it's time to roll up our sleeves and get this done. Thank you, and thank you for all that you do on behalf of Oregon's children and families.
And thank you for all you've done in this, especially. It's been vital. Representative Cruz?
Yeah. And the whole task force is wonderful, but the one person I forgot to mention who has done an incredible amount of work on this was sitting right next to Senator Brzezinski, and she's critical to this. I guess what I would say is it's a draft now, it's available, and so I invite all the players to take a look and see if there's tweaky things we need to do. It's a great document, but we want to have that ready to go. It's being pre-session filed, and I want this to be one of the first orders of business once we are in session in February. It's that important and that critical.
And I would just add, another person who's worked for years on this was Representative Creek.
Yes. And well, and in fact, Representative, I have told Wayne that when that bill comes to the floor of the Senate, I want him at my desk.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. The last item on today's agenda is handling of sexually explicit materials in criminal proceedings. I call John Tannery. I'm sorry. Trinary. Mike Baker and Mark missed the R.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If I may. Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members, just a little bit of history here as we move forward with this. And Detective Trenery is going to, he won't be here very long, Sharon, but it's an issue that we still kind of have problems with for consistency on handling sexually explicit material that's part of evidence that's been collected in the courtroom, or I mean from law enforcement agencies. If you recall, the Adam Walsh Act was passed in 2006 by Congress, signed into law. There are portions that we have moved forward with of that, of the several different applications, legal applications anyways, of the Walsh Act. One you heard a little bit earlier today that dealt with the three-tier system for sex offender registration. That was just one of the things that we've worked on. There's a number of other issues. But this is one here that John's going to share a little bit about more in detail because of his background with Linn County Sheriff's Office and kind of just paint a better picture for you.
Okay, thank you. Please. Just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. Chair Barker, Chair Brzezinski, and members of the Joint Judiciary Committee. I know we're running pretty far behind. My prepared statements are only about 6 to 7 minutes long.
We're so far.
Yes. Hope you'll bear with
me. We got lots of time.
We got plenty of time. We can go to 5 if we have to. No, we don't want to, but we
can. Thank you, sir. My name is John Trenery. I am a cybercrime detective and digital evidence forensic examiner with the Linn County Sheriff's Office. My primary focus and area of expertise is in the investigation of child sexual exploitation over the internet. Many of the crimes I investigate involve the possession of, and all too often the production of, graphic visual recordings of child sexual abuse, or what is colloquially known as child pornography. These graphic pictures and videos of children being sexually abused are not depictions of nameless, faceless children. These are our sons and our daughters. These are our nieces and our nephews. These are our grandchildren and our children's friends. It is often said it takes a village to raise a child, while the same adage of villages is true for the defense of our children. But unfortunately, a hole exists in our state judicial process in which adjudicating contraband child pornography crimes, which expose children to potential additional victimization by the judicial system itself. I come before you today in support of the development of legislation to prevent the process of adjudicating child pornography offenses from unintentionally re-victimizing the children exploited by these crimes, while also balancing the right every defendant has to examine evidence retained by the state that may be offered during court proceedings. Nearly every day in Oregon, defendants or their attorneys are provided with the opportunity to examine contraband evidence such as methamphetamine or heroin or unlawfully modified firearms while the evidence remains in the care and custody of law enforcement. The reasons defense are not allowed to be in possession of such prima facie contraband evidence are obvious, chief among them being that mere possession of contraband is per se illegal. But by allowing for a reasonable opportunity for defense examination of contraband evidence items, the judicial system is able to balance the interest of the defense to examine the evidence with the interest of the state to safeguard and control prima facie contraband. Yet this common sense approach to securing contraband evidence, such as heroin, is not always applied to prima facie contraband child pornography. While rare, it is not unheard of in Oregon for a court to grant defense requests to be provided with duplicate copies of digital evidence containing contraband child pornography, with the understanding that the possession and examination of this contraband evidence will be conducted outside of the custody and control of law enforcement. Such court orders grant carte blanche exception to felony possession of child pornography, so that defense can examine the child pornography free from the inconvenience of government protection and control of this easily duplicated, misplaced, or mishandled graphic depictions of child sexual abuse. While the risk of loss, duplication, or mishandling of child pornography is itself great enough to warrant such orders be forbidden, the unintended consequence of the release from law enforcement control of child pornography is the renewed violation and victimization of the children whose sexual abuse is recorded and depicted in such child sexual exploitation material. In 2006, the United States Congress considered and ultimately passed the Adam Walsh Act, an element of which addressed discovery in child pornography cases. Title V, Sections 501 and 504 of this act, Congress determined several pertinent findings that are relevant to child pornography crimes in Oregon, most notably, number one, child pornography crimes are harmful to the psychological, emotional, and mental health of the children depicted in the child pornography and has substantial detrimental effect on society as a whole. Number two, the advent of the internet and technologies such as digital cameras and inexpensive, large capacity computer systems has greatly increased the ease of child pornography possession, distribution, and production. Number three, every instance of viewing images of child pornography represents a renewed violation of the privacy of the victims and a repetition of their abuse. Number four, child pornography constitutes prima facie contraband and as such should not be distributed to or copied by child pornography defendants or their attorneys. And number five, it is imperative to prohibit the reproduction of child pornography in criminal cases so as to avoid repeated violation and abuse of victims so long as the government makes reasonable accommodations for the inspection, viewing, and examination of such material for the purpose of mounting a criminal defense. The portion of the Adam Walsh Act ultimately codified in Section 3509, Title 18, United States Code, balanced the imperatives of re-victimization prevention with discovery and defense evidence examination of child pornography crimes prosecuted in federal court with just three directives. These directives are, in any criminal proceeding, any property or material that constitutes child pornography shall remain in the care, custody, and control of either the government or the court. The court shall deny any criminal proceeding any request by the defendant to copy, photograph, duplicate, or otherwise reproduce any property or material that constitutes child pornography, so long as the government makes the property or material reasonably available to the defendant. And lastly, the property or material shall be deemed to be reasonably available to the defendant if the government provides ample opportunity for inspection, viewing, and examination at a government facility of the property or material by the defendant, his or her attorney, and individual the defendant may seek to qualify to furnish expert testimony at trial. I've provided electronic copies of the Adam Walsh Act as well as a practitioner's guide to the Adam Walsh Act for your review. I've also provided electronic copies of the revised Code of Washington State to illustrate how our neighbors to the north implemented these federal requirements at the state level. In my opinion, the Washington State implementation improves upon U.S. code by closing a potential loophole that might allow a defendant representing themselves to have unsupervised access to contraband child pornography. In Oregon, the common practice has been for law enforcement to provide accommodations for defense review consistent with those in federal cases. This review involves anything from a cursory examination of contraband digital evidence items with a defendant's attorney, up to and including providing a workspace for the law in the law enforcement facility for the defendant's digital forensic examiner to conduct a full examination of digital forensic evidence items containing contraband child pornography while that digital evidence item remains in the control of law enforcement. Esteemed members of the Joint Judiciary Committee, I come before you today not only as an investigator of online child exploitation offenses, but also as a father to four incredible children. I ask each of you to consider the ethical imperatives of protecting all of our children from the unintentional re-victimization by our judicial process while balancing the right every defendant has to examine evidence that might be offered against them. By codifying into law what is already common practice in Oregon and legally requiring in federal and Washington state courts, we can ensure our judicial system both safeguards the rights of defendants and the safety of our children. By creating common sense legislation in Oregon to require courts to deny defense motions to be provided with reproductions of contraband child pornography, while also requiring law enforcement to provide the defense with an ample opportunity to examine such contraband evidence in a law enforcement facility and under the care and supervision of the government, we can protect our children while respecting the rights of every defendant to examine evidence that might be offered against them. I thank you all, and I'm available for your questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much, Detective. We appreciate your information today.
Is there a bill being proposed or something?
I haven't seen one yet.
I am in the process, yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Are you proposing?
Yes.
Great. Is there any further business? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further business to come before the committee?
I just want to say, Jana said we'd be out by 4:30, and I just didn't think there was any way that would happen.
It's past 4:30. Yeah.
Didn't it happen?
Past 4:30.
Oh, we're in the 5 minutes.
All right.
Yeah, during the House side.
House and the Senate now are adjourned.
Thank you.